Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of The Mark Steiner Show. My name is Aaron Henkin. Why are you hearing my voice right now? You might be asking yourself, who is this sitting in Mark's chair, talking on Mark's microphone? Where is Mark? Where is this radio host I count on every day? Where is his dulcet baritone voice? Where is his infectious laugh, his keen political insights? Fear not, I say to you, please allow me to explain. Mr. Steiner is not hosting his program this hour because, listeners, this hour Mark Steiner is our guest. Believe it or not, Mark has been on the Baltimore radio airwaves for 24 years this year. Let me say that again, 24 years. I think Grover Cleveland was president back then when you started.
His second term.
Radio had just been invented, if I have my facts straight. Anyway, all this is to say that the venerable Mark Steiner gets a celebratory turn in his studio's guest chair this hour. I get the distinct honor of interviewing him. Why? I do not know. I am as underqualified now as I was 15 years ago when I wandered in off the street and started volunteering on this man's radio show. I can tell you, though, in all seriousness, that ever since then, Mark Steiner has been a mentor to me, an inspiration to me, sort of a surrogate crazy uncle to me, all rolled into one. Mark Steiner, I am pleased to say to you, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
It's my pleasure to be here on the Mark Steiner Show. That's wild. Aaron Henkin Show.
We're going to talk shop today. We're going to talk about your broadcast career. But first, let me turn back the clock and have you start by telling the story of when you first became a socially and politically aware young adult and how that awareness started to kind of focus and shape your life from there.
How far back are we going to go?
Well, I don't know. How far back can you remember at this point?
My political consciousness, but it actually started when I was a little boy. I mean, young adult. I wasn't even a young adult yet. I was 11 years old when I ended up as a white kid in an all-black Boy Scout troop in the east side of Baltimore in 1957 when I was 11. That is where things began to explode, really explode. Instances like my good friend Edwin Johnson come to visit me from the east side from our Boy Scout troop, the Faith Baptist Church. We couldn't go to the movies together. We weren't allowed in. He was not allowed in. Or when I was sitting in the back of the car with the scoutmaster one day and four of the other guys, and Mr. Foster said, come on, let's go and get some ice cream. Everybody piled out of the car to get ice cream, and I sat in the back seat looking out the window, and he said, come on, Mark, let's go. I said, no, I'll wait here. He says, no, wherever we can go, you can go. Things like that kept happening. And a Boy Scout at camp and a white troop, we were the only black troop there, started to use the N-word with me about why I was in this troop. So all these things sort of kind of unfolding. And then 2 years later, when I was 13, I found myself walking my first picket line at Mondawmin Shopping Center.
Tell me what you were picketing and how it went down.
Well, I was in Mondawmin. I was not yet 14. I was still 13 with my mom, and we were looking over the railing at Mondawmin, which was then was mostly a white and Jewish shopping center, clientele-wise. And there were these young black people picketing a white coffee pot. And I remember I asked my mother, can I go join that picket line? And my mom said, she was Brit. My mom said, well, dear, you know, we'll ask the picket captain, see what he says. So we went downstairs, and she asked him, was Skip Logan, Clarence Logan, who was a Morgan senior then, and was head of the civic interest group, which was the civil rights group in town, like SNCC. And mom asked if I could join, and he said, sure. He gave me a picket sign, and I marched, and then I joined their group.
And your career as an activist began then and there.
Right, then and there.
Yeah. Tell me about your activism and how it evolved and where it took you from there.
So I was a civil rights worker in Baltimore on the Eastern Shore of Cambridge, Maryland. I ended up being the youngest person arrested in civil rights in the state of Maryland. I found that out because of Fraser Smith's book that he wrote about the history of civil rights. He wrote this page about me. I was, why are you writing about me? And so he said, don't you know you were the youngest person arrested in civil rights in Maryland? I had no idea about that until Fraser wrote the book.
It's kind of a cool record to hold.
It really is cool. And so I was arrested in Cambridge, and we were doing voter registration. I did freedom rides and all throughout the state of Maryland and picketing, got my nose broken and was beaten up pretty badly by the police when they arrested me when I was a kid in Cambridge. And I just stayed active in that movement and went from there to – I joined the Young Socialist Alliance when I was 15.
young socialist.
A young socialist. From there, went to University of Maryland, got involved with SDS, Students for Democratic Society and anti-war movement. I was involved in the abortion underground with my mother. I organized in poor white communities. I mean, I just kept on. I never left.
So in addition to your wide-ranging career and interests as an activist, you ended up somehow involved in becoming a trained actor as well. How in the world did that happen, and how did that kind of fold into your larger picture of who you became as a person?
I always loved acting. And so, you know, from the sixth grade plays on, every school I went to, I joined the drama club or I joined the acting group. But I became really involved in the beginnings of the Washington Guerrilla Theater in Washington, which was street theater that we did in D.C. I did a lot of that. I did a lot of Shakespeare in the early 70s. In college, when I finally went back to college, I just always did it, I guess, because I came from a theatrical family. My mother was theatrical, and we did scenes together, and I would do accents with her all the time. And so it was always just part of what I was. So I got involved in a number of I played in Martin Duberman's In White America in the early 70s, when I played here in Baltimore, when I was at Hopkins, and I just kept on. But my theater was always kind of wrapped in political activism and also therapy, because I studied psychodrama and sociodrama as well as theater. I started two theater companies, one when I was working with young kids at pretrial intervention. We started the pretrial players. And then I started another company called the Family Circle Theater of Kids in Town. Coley Tangela, Sheila Gaskins were part of that group back then.
Tell me about how and when it became clear to you that you were sort of a natural-born teacher on top of everything else, because teaching has always been sort of a part of who you are no matter what you're doing, whether it's acting or political activism or radio. I mean, I can attest everybody who comes in as a producer is also effectively a student of yours.
Well, I don't know. I guess I've always done that too for as long as I can remember. I mean, there's a guy came on my show soon, Dick Cluster, who went to City, and he said, I would argue with people on the back of this bus going to City back in the early 60s about Cuba. Talking about the United States was going to invade Cuba and how what Fidel was. And he said, all those things, and we beat you and yelled at you and screamed at you, but you were teaching us at that time, and you were right, we were wrong back then, you know. And so I've always thought that, you know, you're supposed to impart things that you know. And, you know, I taught at Mervo and Carver. I ran Baltimore Experimental High School as principal. I taught at School for the Arts. I've always taught. Taught at UMBC, just like you teach at UMBC. For all reports, I hear you're an incredible teacher at UMBC.
I did enjoy a stint there, and, coincidentally, small world being that it is, some of my star students from the year that I taught there happen to be working on your show right now.
That's right. It comes full circle.
They came well prepared, I hope.
But teaching has always been something I've done. I've just always done it, and I think that's really important.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This is not Mark Steiner hosting the show. Mark is in the guest seat, the guest of honor on his own program. My name is Aaron Henkin. I'm doing the hosting duties, the honor, I should say, today. I'm a former producer of Mark's. And in case you didn't hear, this year is the 24th anniversary of Mark's broadcast career. So we're taking a little trip down memory lane. We've been talking about Mark's early years as an activist, his early years in the theater. And we're going to fast forward now, Mark, to the moment when you decided what you were going to do next was to reinvent yourself as a radio show host and interview. This was 1992.
Right.
What was going on in your life at the time? How did this idea pop into your head, and how did it become a reality?
I had been working at WJHU on this thing called the History of Jewish Music, a project that didn't come off the ground, that we're trying to resurrect it again now. And it folded for numbers of reasons, mostly to do with the station. David Cray was then the general manager. Dennis Keita was the assistant general manager, who became the general manager. I had spent 3 years learning radio in advertising. I worked with Trey Hansburton and Charles, where I produced, directed, and cast all of the radio commercials here and in New York. And I learned a lot. It was fun. I had a blast. But then I got tired of selling white bread and lottery and beer, and I quit and did some other things.
But you liked the medium.
But I love the medium.
Something spoke to you about it.
And I love the producing. I love making sound, you know. So, and the other thing is, you know, that in my life, I've realized as I look back on my life, almost every 18, 20 years or so of my life, I switch gears. just seems to happen. So this was a switching gear moment. So I was at my dentist's office, Charlie Stein, who was actually had a short broadcast on Nature, Backyard Nature on WJHU back in those days.
Okay.
He was also my natural history mentor when I was a little boy, took me out in the fields, and my father's best friend. But anyway, so I was at his office, get my teeth done, and Dennis Keita was there in the waiting room. So we started talking. And Dennis said, you know, man, and this is the time when JHU was still a classical station, classical music. And he said, you know, we're thinking about starting a public affairs program. And, you know Baltimore from the street corners to the corporate boardrooms. I'm just curious, what do you think? And then out of my mouth, and I have no idea why I said this, out of my mouth popped, you should let me be the host. And he said,
he wasn't asking you for that.
No, he wasn't asking for that. So he said, you don't know anything about radio. What do you mean be the host? I said, I can learn the boards. I mean, I run conversations all the time. I can do this. So he laughed, but he opened the door a little bit. So I hocked him for 3 months. Wouldn't let go. And I said, come on, Dennis, think about this. You know, it'd be fun. So one day he said, okay, Mark, look, this is your phone. This is your desk. I'm taking all things considered off every Tuesday from 7 to 8:30. That's your time slot. No money, no producer. See what you can do. And I took it.
So tell me the story of that first show. You had no idea what you were doing.
No, I never do it.
What was the first show? How did it go? What was going through your head?
I did a couple practice sessions with friends before that. I still have those old tapes. But we did a show on Norplant. It was the very first show, Norplant.
The implantable birth control.
Right. It was put in women's upper arms, mm-hmm. and it was highly controversial. So I had four women in the studio, and they were all kind of health people, two white, two black, and two people on each side of the issue, debating this, had this huge debate for an hour and a half, no breaks, straight through.
Did you take calls?
We took calls.
Yeah.
We took calls.
So what do you remember about facilitating that
conversation? I set some of the callers up because I was afraid people was going to call, so I called friends and said, call in tonight, call in.
Call into the radio show.
Make sure it's you're calling in. And they did, but other people called in too. So
So was it a steep learning curve for you to be sitting behind the radio host chair? I mean, how did you find your rhythm as a host from there on out? Know when to listen, know when to interrupt, know when to redirect. How does one learn those skills?
Well, actually, part of it I have to give to an epiphanal moment I had in the early month I was doing radio. So there was a woman named Allison Barlow, and she was deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. And she said, all of us at Hopkins are listening to your show. We love the show. So we started emailing back and forth. And she said, you know, I see you've been involved in Native stuff before. I said, yeah, I have. She said, well, I'd like to invite you to go. I don't know why they did. Invite me to come to their board meeting in Wisconsin. Well, all these Native people on their board. So I went, the Ojibwe Reservation, flew up with them. So there was this woman there, a Lakota woman, doing a documentary there. And she had everybody sit there in the bathroom, sat in the sink. You sat in the commode, and she was shooting you. And she asked a question about what is communication. I don't recall why they were doing that, but that's what they did. So I gave a long answer. And what I found out when she showed the video was that almost every white and black person in the room had fairly complex answers about what the nature of communication is. Almost every Native in the room said one word.
Listen.
Exactly. Listening. That changed the nature of how I approached the work. It was like I realized that I've always been kind of combative and, you know, clear about what I believed in. But this was like listening was the key. And so that kind of switched things up for me. And just letting people have their say and then listening to what they said and not always projecting your values onto what they say.
Native people and Native culture has always been a big part of who you are and what your philosophy of life is about. Say a little bit more about that affinity and that affiliation.
Well, that was, again, it was my mom. My mom actually had a lot to do with all these things she did to me. I mean, she's the one who got me twisted these things around, so I became the only white kid in an all-black Boy Scout troop in the east side of Baltimore with her way of thinking. And she was always enamored of Native people. She was a Brit, as I said. When we were kids, she made a big deal of saying, you know, she put money into this fund to put Native kids through college. So we used to get all this stuff. And she had all these books on Native American history and Native American culture that I read as a little boy. And I spent time with her on the Seminole Reservation in Florida. where I still have my alligator head from when I was like 8 years old, and that still sits in my house, and that they gave me, and then on the Cherokee Reservation. I started really became close to that, and I started knowing folks in the American Indian Movement during the 60s. The three leaders of that movement were actually people I knew really well. Russell Means ended up being a really, really good friend of mine and was on my show a few times before he passed away. And so it always became a place, but then that same Native Center back in the 90s took me to their summer encampment where I was literally kind of adopted by this Arapaho family and became part of their world and part of their spiritual world, though they made me promise. And when they went, I went to a ceremony of theirs by accident completely, and not accident, I didn't know I was going to be in it. At the end, Sean said to me, and the holy man said to me, we welcome you here, but you can never talk about what we do inside the ceremony. I said, I'll never will. But there's a profound sense they have of something deeper that a lot of indigenous cultures have, whether they're African or whether it's native people here, people who are, the indigenous cultures have a touch with the universe that we've lost.
An interesting sidebar, but I have to stay on track here.
Okay, I'm sorry, man.
Mark Steiner.
Digress?
Wrangling you and keeping you focused. No, I asked the question. But I'm going to bring us back around to your broadcast career. You had your first episode. You made it through. And then that was the beginning of a life on the airwaves and is going on now 24 years later. You've been at it ever since. I'm going to take you for a walk down memory lane here. There's no way, obviously, to touch on everyone you've interviewed, every adventure you've had on the airwaves. So I'm going to mention over the next half hour or so some categories of different sorts of guests, and I'm going to have you pick out some favorite moments and some favorite memories from these conversations along the way. In addition to a lot of political topics, you have a lot of really interesting actors and musicians and have over the years on the airwaves. I name a couple of names here. Nancy Sinatra, Hilary Hahn, the violin prodigy. That was when she was 16 years
16
old.
16 years
she was
old,
a guest
right.
on your show.
Yeah, right.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma, Yuri Timurkhanov, who folks will remember as the conductor of the BSO. You guys took him to a jazz club once.
Yes.
Maybe you'll tell that story. Eartha Kitt was a guest on your show.
Yeah.
And if I have my facts right, she didn't like you at first.
No, not
maybe
at all.
Maybe we'll hear that story, too. Buzu Chavez.
Buzu Chavez and Bojack.
Yeah, Zydeco musicians.
Yes.
Dave Brubeck, jazz legend. Let me just maybe have you pick one or two of those names and regale us with a couple of stories.
Well, Eartha Kitt clearly was from interviewed dozens and hundreds of times and clearly did not want to be up in our studio at 11:30 in the morning to go on the air at noon. She was just not into it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So she walked in. She was in a really bad mood. And so we started talking, and she had nothing to do with my producer back then, Mike Galloway, would not talk to him at all. And then so she and I started talking, and I started making jokes and laughing. We started talking about her history growing up, and I knew a lot about it. And so she asked me about mine. So we started talking and laughing. And by the time we finished, she was just, the entire interview was great and it was very personal, and she kept laughing, and she was the best interview you had. There are a lot of quotes I've seen of yours that have come out. One of them was that if the audience had never loved me, I would never have become Eartha Kitt.
I really do think that. I feel that. And it's so wonderful that every time I walk out on the stage, I'm scared to death. But once
still.
Oh, yes, because you can't take anything for granted. You never know whether they like you for what you have said or something you've done. And in spite of the fact that you may be what they consider fantastic artists, you get punished for all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I get the feeling from the audience that everything's okay, then I feel, okay, thank God, everything's mm-hmm. okay. And therefore, I really do appreciate my work and the feeling that I have for that public. Nobody ever gave me a feeling that I was wanted except the public.
That's part of the skill of being the host of a program, isn't it? Being able to break the veneer, break the ice, to sort of let people know about your own authenticity as a person.
It is, and I think part of it is also that when people come in your studio, you have to understand where they're coming from at that moment, how to read them, what their mood and attitude is. And then how to kind of maneuver around that and how to kind of help them through it so they don't become so uptight, you know. I've only had one or two people in the time of the air that were things that just did not work right.
Are you ready to talk about that? Because I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna ask you, what was your most disastrous interview? Which was the one that just left you wanting to bang your head against the wall?
Well, a couple. One was this Ray Bradbury, believe it or not,
the great science fiction,
the great science fiction writer. He's coming to town to speak at Hopkins. I was so excited that he was coming on the show. I'd read everything he'd ever written. I loved his work. I really loved his work. So he comes in the studio. We start talking, and I think my first question, so his statement was something about Aldous Huxley and George Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave him my theory about Orwell and Huxley. And his response to me was, well, clearly you know nothing about either author, never read them. I'm like, whoa!
That's how the conversation started.
That's how it started.
And then you realize you got an hour on the air with
yes.
Him.
Fahrenheit 451, as I'm sure many people have told you, is a book that when I was a kid just had such an impact. I read that about the same time that I read Brave New World and read Orwell's 1984.
That's right.
They all seemed to hit at that time. But let me ask you about that. I've always been curious about this one thing. Many people, when they read Brave New World or they read Orwell stuff, there's, in some senses, a fear of that's what's going to happen with capitalism run amok and taking over the future. But I get a sense from reading some of the other things you've written, that you didn't have the same impetus when you wrote Fahrenheit 451.
Well, you know, you've got it wrong about capitalism running amok.
Okay.
That's not George Orwell's book was not about that.
No,
it's about communism dominating Europe,
mm-hmm.
and his experience as a communist or a member of the Communist Party in discovering what monsters they were.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote Big Brother. He wrote about communism and the history of their destroying 60 million people. That's what that book was about. It wasn't about capitalism at all.
Okay, I guess I say that because I get a sense a lot of times from what I've read, other things that he's written, that he and Huxley and others worry about any kind of authoritarian structure looming
yeah,
large.
Yeah, but ours is not an authoritarian structure. The communists, the fascists, and the Nazis had totalitarian structures. We are a democratic society, and we don't have anything like that. So you've got it completely wrong.
But then we got this conversation about other things, about his theories, and he said something on the air about the greatest problem with Africa is that the Europeans left too soon. And I went, what?
That was your turn to take issue with him.
Really? I said, you know, what are you talking about?
Wow.
They weren't ready to govern themselves.
I had to go back to the archives and listen to
it. It was just the most intense. And then the worst part was, afterwards, when he got on stage to speak, he talked about this idiot that interviewed him on public radio earlier in the day, and that idiot was me.
Oh. Stories of failure are always the best stories.
That was probably the worst.
You're getting
the worst moment.
From the horse's mouth, Mark Steiner, the guest of honor here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Aaron Henkin. I'm guest hosting, talking with Mark about his 24-year career this year on the radio airwaves, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. My name is Aaron Henkin. I'm guest hosting Mark Steiner's show today. Why? Because our guest of honor on the Mark Steiner Show is none other than Mark Steiner. Mark Steiner, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Good to be on the Mark Steiner Show, still.
Why are we doing this? In case you did not know, Mark has been on the broadcast radio airwaves for 24 years this year. I am a former producer of Mark's. He has always been a mentor to me. He's like a crazy uncle to me, a longtime friend. And so it's my honor to get to take a trip down memory lane here this hour with Mark as our guest and talk about some of the many adventures he's had.
And now producing one of the most creative programs out there.
I thank you for saying that.
Out of the block. Incredible program.
You've brought in a lot of ragamuffins off the street who had nothing going on in their lives other than a table waiting career and turned them into productive members of society.
And so you were a waiter, and Mark Grinry was a fishmonger.
You know how to pick them. You have wide and varied musical tastes.
I do.
Including an inexplicable passion for Zydeco music.
Always.
People always hear Steiner talking about Zydeco music. Whence the roots of that?
Probably the first time I heard Zydeco music was in the, I want to say, late 60s, 70, when I drove through New Orleans and hung out in Louisiana and New Orleans and then hung out in southwestern Louisiana for a while, just for like a few days, and went to this bar, and all of a sudden there were all these folks up on the stage, black folks in cowboy clothes playing this music. And I'm going, and it was just jamming, and I couldn't stop dancing all night, right? So I just fell in love with Zydeco from that point on. And so when we first started the show, there were two men who were vying to be, who people call alternately the kings of Zydeco. One was Buzu Chavez, and the other was Bojack. And they both passed away since. Buzu was an older guy. Bojack was a big, imposing guy, 6'4", lovely man. And so I had we did the battle for the kings of Zydeco on the show. And so we interviewed Buzu and Bojack. And the funniest part was so we got to start off with Buzu. I was going crazy in Buzu's house going, "Buzu? Where's Buzu? You see Buzu? Is Buzu here? Wait, is he out there with the chickens? No, I think he's feeding the cows. Somebody go out to the chicken coop and see if Buzu's in the chicken coop." So... I want to replay that show. We've never replayed that show.
Yeah.
To replay the King of Zydeco would be a blast.
Actors and film people, you've had many through your doors. Any particular favorites that come to the top of your mind?
Well, no, we interviewed everybody who acted or wrote for The Wire.
Yeah.
I interviewed John Waters a lot over the years.
I remember those conversations,
and I would just be under the table. I mean, he was so funny.
It's hard to wrangle that guy when you're in a conversation with him. I've witnessed you do it though.
Yeah, it's
somehow.
He's very tough. You know, he's very tough. We talked about this years ago back about being young and how much you hated school and being in Catholic schools so rigid and stuck there.
Well, I only went to one college. I hated all schools.
What was your high school?
Calvert Hall. Yeah, yeah, I really hated that one. Yeah. But they just discouraged every interest I ever had. So that is a reason to hate a school. You're supposed to go to school to be encouraged for your interests. I'm not sure any school would have encouraged my interests at that time in my life. But you go to school to figure out what you want to be. I knew. I should have quit school when I was 12. I would have made 3 more movies.
But you never got drafted.
Oh, I went down there. I know what to check. I knew how to check. I thought I was a gay junkie that wet my bed, everything. And I was against the war, but I remember going down there and seeing the draft board and coming back on the bus. I didn't even have to take the whole test because I was too skinny, too. But I remember thinking later that many people on that bus probably did die in Vietnam.
That's right.
And yet I knew not one person that didn't die in Vietnam. But all the people that lived on the bus, I bet didn't know anybody that died of AIDS, and half my friends died of AIDS 20, 30 years later. So something hits every generation. It's a war or whatever it is. So there's still terrible, no matter what. I got out of that one, but I didn't, and I luckily escaped the other one.
Right.
You don't know what's going to happen, and I look back on that and feel lucky. I very, very lucky that I did.
My affinity for acting is part of why I love doing people who do films and people who are in theater, because I can feel and relate to their work and what they do. It's always been, you know, talk to people about their craft, about how they approach their work, how they get into character.
You mentioned The Wire. From a television entertainment standpoint, that is the most impactful entertainment spectacle that has defined this town since John Waters and his version of Baltimore.
Yeah.
Talk about just what a phenomenon The Wire was. I remember I was producing your show when it came on, and we started getting screener DVDs.
Right.
And we were just like, whoa, what is this about? What's going on
right
here? And then to see it go so many seasons in so many different directions and come to define this city to such an extent. What was it like to have those conversations with David Simon and all of the actors who were involved in making that portrayal of Baltimore?
It was also the whole body of work. It was the homicide. It was the coroner, that my old friend, the actor and director, Charles Dutton.
Rock
did it, you know, who I taught theater to when he was in a prison back in the 70s. But I think that what The Wire did, and there's a lot of critiques about The Wire, and I've made them myself, which I think there's a layer. Let me just start here. There's a missing layer in The Wire, which is the passion, love, and integrity that happens in the poorest communities in the black world that a lot of people don't put in. And I think that was missing a lot in The Wire to me. But having said that, he produced a piece of work, that gave more black actors work than any other single production in the history of television or film until that moment, and allowed people to create characters that were very real, right? Andre Royo, right? When he played Bubbles, remember? And so he when I interviewed him, and we brought him down to meet Woody Curry, who ran the station, which is who he partially...
Drug rehabilitation center.
Right. How he developed his character. And those characters were real, and they were made white America look at the reality. They just drive through every day and refuse to accept, refuse to acknowledge, and don't look at. And he did that in ways that were extremely powerful. People probably gave us a negative image of the city. Well, it gave an image of the city that people needed to pay attention to, right? And David, you know, is a... he's brilliant. It's the reasons why he never was nominated for an Emmy. Not once was he nominated for an Emmy.
I never realized that.
Which is crazy. One of the other things that like, fascinates me is I think the challenges of viewer psyche, the American psyche watching The Wire, is the question of honor and humanity and the levels on which it's found and where it's not. And how it crosses all planes from the corner to police officers, whoever else you're portraying. And that's something that really challenges kind of our notion of what honor, honesty, and humanity mean.
Right. I'm not interested in, like, labels of good and evil. Like, this guy's a drug dealer, so he's evil. Or this guy's a cop, so he's good. That whole dynamic is the pornography of American entertainment. And I'm tired of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it bores the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just after something else. We were trying to look at systems and systemic failure. We were depicting an America that has become a can't-do country. We can't get the intelligence right on Iraq. We can't tell ourselves the truth about No Child Left Behind and look behind the stats. You know, we can't tell ourselves that our police department is making up stats so a guy can be elected governor. You know, it's like whatever the task is, you know, we will somehow find a way not to do it. That, to me, is America at the millennium. I'm sorry to say.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Mark Steiner, our guest of honor this hour. My name is Aaron Henkin. I'm the guest host, former producer of Mark's here on this program. We are celebrating Mark. This year is his 24th year on the radio airwaves. We're talking about some conversations of note from over the past 2.5 decades on the air. You have had really interesting experiences interviewing other interviewers, right?
Yeah.
Talk about some of the folks that have come through your door and sat down across the table from you, whose job is also to interview folks.
Well, a couple of them, especially public radio, people like Ira Glass, mm-hmm. Bill Moyers, which I found to be a fascinating interview. They'd started doing Genesis Project, the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, which is how Valerie and I became really good friends. I think in many ways was with our work together there. So we produced this entire series built around Bill Moyers' work on Genesis with black and white congregations, Jewish and Christian and Muslim congregations across the city. Bill Moyers is such a deep thinker. It was kind of, I just loved kind of pulling out of him the roots of what made him produce Genesis.
I've always felt that, I guess perhaps there's a Jewish part of me that always felt that Eve got a bum rap, that when you come down to it, what she saw in that apple was beauty. It was a beautiful piece of fruit, pleasure. It was delicious to eat, and knowledge. And out of this deep-seated curiosity, desire for beauty, pleasure, and knowledge, she reached for it. And for that, she received what in the Bible is an eternal punishment. And I always thought, what's wrong with wanting pleasure, beauty, and knowledge? And I'm on Eve's side in that. Although there must be something there about boundaries, something there about overreaching. And this is one of the puzzling conundrums to me of the biblical story. What was the sin that was so offensive to God that the storyteller issued this punishment, this penalty, on the woman who wanted beauty, pleasure, and knowledge?
Studs Terkel used to love visiting with you.
Oh.
He loved being interviewed by you.
He did. I was one of only two public radio hosts, other than community radio hosts, that he, whose show he would go on. Hmm. One was mine and one was at NYC. And I just love Studs. If I have a radio hero in terms of interviewing, the only person it would be Studs.
What makes him your hero?
Because he gave voice to the voiceless. Because he understood the struggle for racial justice and understood it in terms of giving voice to working class people on your radio show, about understanding the depth of culture and putting that on your radio show, about knowing that racial justice was beyond just the political struggle. It had to do with the core marrow of America. And he understood that. And he respected everybody. If you don't respect the people you're interviewing, you shouldn't be interviewing them. You shouldn't be doing the job. And he respected everybody, whether they were PhDs or whether they were dropped out of grade school and were working as laborers. He just respected everybody fully in the depth of their intellect and had a passion for what America could be. I mean, he was very political, right? Studs Terkel was my radio god.
Well, my outlook has to be hopeful. See, the name of the book I wrote before this one was about certain kinds of people who always were there putting their necks out. I called them the prophetic minority, prescient minority. They were the abolitionists during slavery days. They were the young guys and women who spoke out against the Vietnam War when it happened and were beaten up, and later on they were joined by the majority. They're the ones who speak out now. They're the ones who represent what Thomas Paine was all about. He said, this is the country, United States, like no other ever in the history of the human species. It's where the commoner can say to the king, bugger off. It's where a common man, ordinary person, can say to a president, if he thinks he's wrong, bugger off. That's what it's all about.
You just recently had a really interesting conversation with the interviewer and radio host Krista Tippett.
Yeah.
From On Being.
Right.
Yeah. She has an interesting way of interviewing people as well.
She does. She's a great interviewer. I love her interviews. And they're very different. I mean, she's... Someone complained about our interview with Krista, one of the people in the audience, saying that it was too deeply philosophical. Well, that's one of the really things I love about her, is that her interviews are that, and they're about what's under what we call the pragmatic and the practical to who we are as a species and being, on being. Maybe that's why she calls her show On Being. But she was great. I mean, I met her because at one of the public radio program directors' conventions I used to go to frequently, used to go to all the time, when she first presented her show, I remember nobody seemed to pick up on it. I went up to her and said, Krista, this is a bad show. I mean, really good show. And I'm going to put it on WYPR as soon as we get back. So we were the first station to pick her up, actually.
It was called Speaking of Faith.
Speaking of Faith.
Yeah.
And we picked her up and put her on the air. And now she's brilliant. Yeah. And listening to me, I was just thinking about something I've said all along when I talk about talking to other people. No matter if it's somebody who has an exact opposite political or philosophical or religious view from you, who's from a place that you don't accept nor even think you accept, that the truth lives in every corner. Mm. You can find it. Part of what your book is saying as well is we have to be open to understanding and learning if we're going to create this beloved community. You talk about King a number of times throughout this book.
I think we have to be open to the humanity of the other,
right,
even if we don't agree.
Right.
And we have to do that because we are in community, because, in fact, we're in relationship. It can be a good relationship. It can be a bad relationship. We are in relationship in a democracy, in a globalized world. the point is not necessarily that we reach agreement or that we change each other's minds, but how do we live together? How do we possibly come together around some questions we share, some challenges we share as a society? Again, even if we have conflicting answers.
You mentioned Charles Dutton, Rock, spending time with him when he was in prison. You've interviewed people who were in prison as well.
Oh, yeah, I've done a lot. I mean,
you've done conversations at juvenile justice facility, Hickey.
Hickey.
And you went to Jessup to interview Eddie Conway.
Right.
Tell me that story.
Well, first of all, I've known Eddie for a long time. I knew Eddie before he went to jail, and I knew Eddie, and I stayed close to him ever since. It took a lot to open up the penal system, the correction system, to allow us to go in and to interview Eddie. We had to go through a whole lot, and we were finally able to get some people to help us break through who were political figures. I called and said, could you please open this door? So we got in and we got to interview him. And they put us in this little room, and he walked in with these chains on. And I remember I was saying, you know, like, I convinced them to take the chains off of him so I could interview him in the room, and they did. As a matter of fact, your old co-producer, Lisa Morgan, was the one who was with me that day taping that interview with Eddie Conway.
Wow.
But it was a chance for him to really have his story told. So we did that. We've done other pieces, too. Flint Gregory Hunt, he was on death row. And we were the only radio allowed in to interview him. And that was a series we did on the air that was very powerful and very emotional. Some of the people who worked at the station back then actually knew the woman he killed. So it was a very emotional kind of piece, and that went all over the country, that particular interview.
You've interviewed people from all walks of life over the years, from folks who were in prison to heads of Maryland government. I mean, you've had just about every Maryland governor in recent history on the show. Schaefer, Glendening, Ehrlich, O'Malley, Hogan now. Mayors from Schmoke to O'Malley to Dixon to... Stephanie Rawlings Blake to now Mayor Pugh.
Ms. Pugh.
Who's the slipperiest politician that you've ever had to interview?
The slipperiest politician. That's a tough one to ferret out.
That's a high bar, isn't it?
It's a high bar.
Yeah.
It's a high bar. They're all, you know, they all dance.
Yeah.
They all dance.
It's a special kind of challenge to interview a politician, isn't it?
And to get them to really be honest and straightforward. Probably the most straightforward person was Schaefer. I think he was the most straightforward person.
Who was the most combative?
In an enjoyable sense, was Ehrlich.
Yeah. I suspected you were going to say that.
He didn't.
You two had kind of a love-hate relationship.
We did. He loved coming on the show, and there's these great photos of us at Annapolis Summit they did years back when he was governor, when it looks like we're actually about to have a physical fight, but we weren't. I think he was the most combative, but it was enjoyable combat.
Let me ask you to talk about what's changed and what hasn't. Well, let me just start here in Baltimore from the time when you were interviewing, having conversations with Mayor Schmoke to now maybe your most recent conversations with the Mayor Pugh. What stays the same and what changes?
What stays the same is I think that we have not come to grips with the systemic racism and poverty in Baltimore City. Poor inner city communities in Baltimore, by that I mean economically poor, in the last 24 years have gotten worse, not better. More isolated, more desolate, less cared about. The power of the developers has just grown and grown and grown. That's a dangerous factor in the future of this city. That's something that grabs me more than anything. I mean, I was thinking about that. We were thinking about pulling out some of the older shows we did around housing, policing, education, and seeing just how much has changed or not changed in 24 years. You know, and it has not. I mean, our schools in so many ways have gotten less money, not more money. It's very upsetting to me to see the state of the city. I think it's just gotten worse since I've become... And it's a horrible thing to say. I mean, I know there's this influx of young people moving in. There's all these nightlife happening, which is lovely. Cities need that. But what's been forgotten are the majority of the people in this city. And that to me is the most horrendous political crime of my 24 years.
In the minutes that we have left, I want to have you talk about some of the larger series that you've undertaken over the years on the radio airwaves. And I want to start by a series that took listeners way out of Baltimore and Maryland and the U.S. To Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
Series called Shared Weight, Wandering Souls. Talk about what that series was, what your goal was, and what happened when you got a team of people together and went to Vietnam.
That particular series, it started because I wanted to do something around the anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And then I met a man named Wayne Carlin, who'd been on the show, who was a Marine Corps veteran, who was a great writer, and taught at Southern Maryland. He became literally the co-producer of the series. And we wanted to go in and have American vets go to Vietnam, vets who had been involved in the creative arts and in writing, and meet with their counterparts in Vietnam who fought on the other side, who also now were artists. So we ended up doing these incredible stories. The most amazing piece to me was when we started this, Wayne got a letter from this vet. His name was Homer Steatley. And Homer wrote to Wayne saying, I have this diary of the first man I killed in Vietnam. I want to find his family and give it back. It's been haunting me since the day I killed him. And Hun Nhuc Dam was the man that he killed in Vietnam. So Wayne put ads in the newspapers in Vietnam and found the family. So Homer's story became, to me, one of the most powerful stories we've ever told. I'm really proud of that particular episode. I liked all six episodes. There were Woody Curry's episode. All of them were really powerfully done. But Homer's, for me, was giving you the sense of what war really tasted like, what it felt like to be shot at and almost killed, what it felt like to have a man's brain blow up in your face, and what it felt like to kill another human being, so people understand what war is about. And Homer... is one of the most amazing men I know.
When I opened that envelope, it was with a great deal of trepidation. And then reaching my hand in and touching those documents, touching the notebook, I had the real sensation that I was touching Dom, because I was physically touching what I knew his family, what I knew the Vietnamese believed was what was left of his soul, what the part of his soul that could be brought back to the family, and which had now been given over to me. This soul was now, you know, in my house.
I want to talk to you about another series, and this is one that you undertook while I was your producer. This was early 2000s, Voices of the Holy Land.
Oh, yeah.
Tell listeners what that series was and what it entailed.
Well, you know, this is one of the times when the Israelis and Palestinians were in a ferocious battle and killing one another. Buses blowing up, Israelis killing Palestinians, Palestinians blowing up Israeli buses. And so we decided to do a series where we would hear the voices of people from every side in that struggle, unfiltered, not in debate with one another, just hearing their voices, whether it was a Orthodox Jewish Zionist or a Palestinian mother. That was a very powerful series that we did. And Miss Madden helped on that series as well, if you remember, right?
Mary Rose Madden.
Mary Rose Madden, yes.
There's bombing all night. It's unbelievable. And we can't live with it, you know? I can't take it anymore. And I can't live in bombing and shooting all day long. Okay, we are human beings, and this is so unfair. I'm only 18. People in other countries care now about the proms and their graduations and the dresses, and all I care about is living, you know? I just want to live till tomorrow comes, and it's not happening. I'm dying 10 million times every day. People my age are so frustrated. Can you believe 18-year-olds are now so frustrated? 15-year-olds, even 10-year-olds are now talking about death, talking about not sleeping at night, talking about nightmares. We are suffering. We are children right now. We have the right to live, for God's sake. And they are not paying attention to all that.
That was a real education for me. I got to tell you, I started as a volunteer on your show in summer of 2001. My first official week of employment as your interim producer at the time of the Mark Steiner Show was the first week of September 2001. I'd been working on your show like 1 week when 9/11 happened. And then you and I got down to business of trying to figure out what your role was here in Baltimore on the airwaves and what people needed you for. And things got very serious very quickly.
They did.
And in addition to, yeah, in addition to all the local conversations, I remember getting on these, getting these long distance phone, international phone numbers for you and making these calls. And I want to remind you that at one point you got the satellite phone number for an unknown at the time Afghani man by the name of Hamid Karzai.
Right.
I remember being in the control room and dialing up this number. And there's this man on the other end of the sat phone saying, like, I've only got a couple of minutes to talk because, you know, they're, like, tracking us. They're after us. I'm in the mountains. I patched him through to you. You remember that conversation?
I do very well.
Tell that story.
So Hamid Karzai, his brother, lives in Baltimore. Kayum, who was a friend. And Kayum actually set that up for us with his brother. He had just been smuggled out of Pakistan, we learned later, on a helicopter, dumped in the middle of nowhere, and was hiding in a cave. One of the things he said to me at the end of the conversation, I remember he said, asked what day this was.
Yeah.
Didn't even know what day it was. And it was a very intense and passionate conversation. He was one of the Pashtun leaders. And I remember I tried to give it to National Public Radio. I called the folks at Morning Edition, All Things Considered. Nobody would take the story. I'm saying, look, this guy is coming back in. He's one of the leaders. He could be president. He said, oh, we don't ever heard of him. And they didn't pick it up. But so we were the first media outlet to talk to Hamid Karzai as he came back into Afghanistan after the Americans attacked.
And it wasn't too long after that until he became president of Afghanistan.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Folks, I just want to declare that it has been an absolute pleasure to get to spend this hour on the radio airwaves with Mark Steiner. Mark, you are and continue to be a radio and personal inspiration and mentor to me, and always to me will be my crazy surrogate uncle. I guess the last thing I'll ask you is, what do you think you're going to be doing 24 years from now? You still going to be interviewing people?
You
talk about changing gears every couple of decades.
We are changing gears. We have some projects we're trying to create now that are very different. We're off to do this documentary with Martin Luther King's barber.
Wow.
In Montgomery, Alabama, coming up in April. That's going to be coming up. We're going to hit it for audio and for the visuals and see what that takes us. We've got a bunch of other projects we're working on. Yeah, I'm feeling like shifting of gears is taking place. I'm not sure just exactly where that's going to take me. But Studs Terkel was like 96 years old, who died writing his last book at his typewriter. So
that's the way to go.
That's the way to go.
I love you, Mark.
Love you
too,
bro.
This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Aaron Henkin in for Mark Steiner. Our guest this hour on the Mark Steiner Show has been Mark Steiner. You have been tuned to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.